darkly splendid abodes, the official podcast of Toronto Thelema, exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Dipping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. The Holy Guardian Angel usually begins to speak with us long before knowledge and conversation is attained. But this speech is often fleeting, taking the form of subtle signs, hints, and experiences meaningful only to ourselves. Edward Mason and I will discuss this elusive mode of communication and interaction. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Love is the law, love under will.
Welcome to season 4 of Darkly Splendid Abodes. Well, I guess we may have had, I don't know if this will be the first episode, but it'll be the first one welcoming Edward Mason back.
I am welcome. Thank you. It's fun to be here.
What do we have on the agenda for today? We want to talk about, I'll be honest with you, I've gone completely blank, but I believe it was something along the lines of the Holy Guardian Angel. Adjacent.
I think it's important to talk about being completely blank, because I think that might be the point where the HGA can finally intervene wholeheartedly on us. But
well, see how I segued that for you?
Yes, isn't that wonderful? That was brilliant. I guess what was buzzing through my head as I was thinking about this talk and thinking of the things I should have added to my notes. One key thing with a lot of magicians is we're not absolutely neurotypical, if there is such a thing as neurotypical. It tends to be a pejorative term used by people who are on the something like the autistic spectrum or have attention deficit issues and so on. But we all bring these odd perspectives and brain-related attitudes to magic. And we assume that at some point we discover that what we're really after is this knowledge and conversation of this Holy Guardian Angel entity. I was involved in a pointless argument with somebody a couple of months ago. I always try to avoid pointless arguments, and then, of course, I step into one. The guy's comment was, well, who knows what the knowledge and conversation is or the Holy Guardian Angel anyway? And I thought, well, anyone I've met who actually says they've had KNC has a very definite knowledge of what it is, but that you cannot convey it precisely simply because it is such an individual process and there is no one road that leads there for everybody. Mm-hmm. We remember that Crowley said he liked the term Holy Guardian Angel because it would confound the metaphysical man. It's not necessarily a guardian in the ordinary sense. Angel is a complete misnomer. I would go for holy in my own perspective on it, but I think even Crowley argued that that was a misnomer as well. It's like Jung's term, individuation, which defies easy definitions because it's about one individual's efforts to connect with what is simultaneously the most rarefied and also the most comprehensive source point in our own lives. So once you start coming out with statements like that, you've already crossed the line a little bit, but in order to discuss the topic at all, you have to at least stand on the borders. Crowley presented Liber Samech as a means of completing knowledge and conversation, especially with the commentary he adds, the Scholion, which defines a lot of things in that book that I think he wrote for the Australian guy, Progradio, was it?
Yeah, Frank Bennett. Yeah.
Yeah. Then, of course, there is the sacred magic of Abramelin the Mage, which has been around for centuries. And, of course, everybody ends up customizing things because you're on this relationship that keeps on evolving and becoming more complicated. But there's two points I think that are critical. One is knowledge and conversation. It was told to me early on, these are both old terms, and we're talking sort of Renaissance era for sexual intimacy. Carnal knowledge we talk about, and of course, conversation is the synonym for the word intercourse. You're actually not just having a relationship with the angel, but knowledge and conversation is a consummated relationship where this thing is fully present in your life, fully active, and dropping little hints in your ear all the time, even if the relationship, like any relationship, has an ebb and a flow to it. And there are times when the magician will think, you know, where is this knowledge, this HGA entity gone to? And other times when it seems like the energy is in full flood. And it can be rather hard to predict those because the relationship is constantly moving on to subtler and more comprehensive and more informative levels of nature.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that I realized when I've sort of been able to prod people and say, you know, so what did you mean by that remark about the HGA a while ago? And you get people dropping stuff into the conversation. And I was surprised at how many different things that come up for people. One person told me that her HGA indicated its presence because she heard the smell of roses.
Heard and the I thought, smell.
noticed the smell, scented the smell, or smelled the smell of roses. Yes, let's not get things too neuro-untypically confused.
I thought you were being especially creative with your wordplay.
Oh, I was, but I realized I'm far too subtle for this audience, so I should simplify my language. And then there are other things that come up. One person told me about a prickling on the scalp, which meant the crown chakra, the Ketha center, is activated and there's an awareness of energy coming up there. Somebody else mentioned a scent of incense when there wasn't any incense around being lit. Some people get a particular image, maybe not permanently, but at a certain phase of life, there's a consistent image that comes through that is very vivid. And then you get just simply a name or a thought that keeps coming into your head, which is this being, entity, force, presence, totality, trying to say hum, because it doesn't really speak humanese, let alone speak English. It speaks HGAEs, and it's communicating stuff that is, we have to use the awkward phrases here, vibrationally accelerated beyond what human consciousness normally deals with.
Hmm.
Another thing that can happen is a sudden silence, quite a common thing, like, everything feels quiet. There might be sounds happening elsewhere, but there is a sudden absence of noise, which might simply be the mind shutting down all of its background stuff. You might be in the middle of a ritual, and suddenly all the distracting stuff has stopped, and you're solely fixed on that hexagram or pentagram or sigil or whatever you're visualizing, and that's the only thing there. The mind has gone dead quiet. Another thing, this is something I've had in the past, a shift in lighting conditions.
Mm.
Things for me would suddenly go whiter. I tagged it Dutch light because it was like the kind of light I remembered seeing on a particular cloudy day more than once when I did business trips to the Netherlands. And particularly I was in Amsterdam two or three times, and suddenly there was this subtle light that I had not seen in Canada, but it was there, a kind of whiteness, a paleness, and it kind of shows up in some of Vermeer's paintings. It was just a kind of consciousness shift. It didn't mean, you know, the angel is now present and is trying to communicate something telepathically. It was just a kind of nudging reminder not to get too caught up in mundane stuff. Now, there can be, you know, masses and masses of other stuff happening inside of us, but that was just a bunch of suggestions I wanted to throw out as hints, as guides to getting in touch. I think part of the problem with knowledge and conversation is, of course, it's a total thing. Yeah, I think I can share this one. Many, many, many years ago, when I was far too young to know exactly what was going on, I had a particular experience that I was put in mindfulness in dhyana in the most intense and traumatically disquieting way imaginable. It was a kind of a foretaste of stuff that has showed up over the years. It lasted several hours, and I completely shifted my intentions for my life, my plans, my everything from that moment on. But of course, I had no idea what had hit me. It was very bizarre to do it, you know, bass-ackwards. You're supposed to do all of this meditation and ritual work and devotional stuff and write out, you know, papers and autobiographical materials and so on. And then finally you get to the, you know, the on-ramp where hopefully this thing happens. Instead, I got kicked out of mundane consciousness for several hours and just had no idea how to frame the experience because I couldn't incorporate it into my 20-year-old mind. I wasn't there. Yeah, I'd done a couple of hours of very dodgy Buddhist meditation at that point. I'd read a bunch of books. I was familiar with names like Dion Fortune, Gareth Knight, Israel Righardi, and so on, and I dipped into their stuff without really having much idea what was going on. But it was something that completely knocked me sideways and left me needing to figure out what to do in relation to it, which I will say I've been trying to do for half a century since. I'm not going to go into any more autobiographical details for two reasons. One is it is a very intimate process. But secondly, the more you tell people about what you went through personally, the more they form an idea of, oh, that's what has to happen. I'm really mentioning this to point out that I don't think many of us actually do follow the standard track of an accelerating exploration of individual selfhood that leads us to an awareness of the divine in within that selfhood that suddenly leads to a blossoming. That's the theory. That's what's in the books. That's what they tell you ought to happen. But it might not follow anything like that direct track. I don't know if all of that makes sense, but I just want to lay down a basic idea that you probably will not find this entire business follows a standard set of procedures.
Yeah, I think the whole idea of what you started this discussion with was referring to somebody saying, well, I don't think anybody knows what that HGA thing is like or whatever the wording of that was. It seems like the challenge tends to be the fact that just by saying something, you see like a reverberation of the idea. For instance, you could say that the KNC knowledge and conversation experience is a quantifiable experience. And then there will be people who that reverberates with and who just parrot the statement. And then you can say that it's like, well, no, you can't quantify it because it's going to be an individual subjective experience. And then that reverberates and it turns into something like, well, I don't think anybody knows what it, you know what I mean? It's that kind of just kind of bouncing back the information. And usually if that's all it is without any kind of personal direct experience or work towards the experience, then you're just ending up with something that's degraded. It's like the information ends up degraded by the time it's reverberated down to that point.
It's not just degraded, it becomes a fixed idea that you hang on to that can then obstruct the actual signals that are coming through. That's why people are very reticent about saying a great deal about their own processes here. The one manual, I suppose, that I've always looked to is not just Liber 65, the Book of the Heart girt with the serpent, but the commentary that Crowley supplied to that and circulated to his followers. You might remember the Temple of Our Lady of the Stars did a small published version of that some years ago. I think mm-hmm. there's still copies available from the Circle of Stars Pronaos in Toronto. But you find in that, I've been going through it a lot recently, repeatedly, talking about the sexual intimacy, phrases like darling fool, oh my lover, oh my beloved, oh my maker, my master, my mate. That can be a little bit uncomfortable, especially if you come out of a Judeo-Christian relationship where it's kind of a sort of rather respectful attitude toward the boss that's in there. This is so much more intimate to the essence of a person's being. And let's be blunt, a lot of the verses are highly erotic, but they're both heteroerotic and homoerotic. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff, oh, honey boy, oh, I can't think of the things, of course, right now. I didn't bother to jot them
down. It carries over in Liber 7 as well. There's a lot of that, yes. Kind of my beautiful... oh, God, now I'm going to go blank as well. Back
we
to that.
We know it's there. We've mentioned the books. People could go and look it up themselves. We're not going to do all the work for them. There's also the fact that, as Liber 65 says in chapter 1, lo, thou yieldest not. Go thou unto the outermost places and subdue all things. Subdue thy fear and thy disgust. Then yield. Now, Crowley tried doing everything disgusting as he could think of when he was in Cefalù in Sicily in the early 1920s. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we all have to go and mimic that. I don't know whether he got that much out of it. But I mean, there was this whole thing of people not washing themselves, which I thought was rather dangerous. And one of the children died, which possibly implies that, you know, lack of personal hygiene is not the way to spiritual illumination. But of course, what disgusts and frightens me as a person might be nothing to someone else. So each of us has to find his or her own battleground. It just, you have to look at the things that make you most ashamed, most uncomfortable, that you most want to conceal from other people, and then really do some work on those areas. What is it about this that is important to me? Because if I'm ashamed of something, if I feel there's a weakness or a vulnerability, why is that so important? I mean, I can't juggle or tap dance. It doesn't bother me in the slightest that I can do neither one. They're not skills that I have ever needed in my life. Yet certain situations where I have to deal with technically competent people leave me feeling really nervous. And that could be an electrician or the mechanic I'm talking about my car who says, you need this, this, and this replaced. And I think, I don't even know what two of those this is are. And I'm feeling completely lost. That's a different thing that I have had to look at in the past and say, okay, it's okay not to know every kind of specialized knowledge on the planet. But that's the stuff that we need to go to in the outermost places where we must subdue all things. Subdue thy fear and thy disgust. Then you can yield. Then you can open out to this thing that you're trying to reach to. The other thing, of course, is the HGA is not this stuff as opposed to that stuff. Nice as opposed to nasty or light as opposed to dark. Among other things, it is just simply going to be the quintessence of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I've also spent a lot of time recently on Liber Ararita, Liber 813, where Crowley goes through the Tree of Life in each of the seven verses. And at one point, he's doing the clipothic versions of each Sephira, and then he's talking about different aspects of the Sephiroth. And just this thing is not any one of these specific virtues or horrible entities, because by the power of the being 418, he's resolved everything into the 12 rays of the crown, and the 12 rays are one. Everything comes back to a source point. Now, a mundane tool, I think, that tends to get a bit downgraded But I think most of the occult schools that I'm aware of ask for it at some point. They tell people to do an autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't need to be 350 pages of, you know, it was a dark and stormy night when I was born in 1979. And, you know, my mother said, oh, this kid's going to be trouble the moment I was born. Or so my auntie told me. You don't have to put all of that in. But looking at what comes up for you is interesting. That when you set out to tell your own story to yourself, you find that certain things happen in your life that, oh, there was so much that went on in those days. And you look at it and think, yeah, but it was kind of, overall, it didn't teach me a whole lot. Whereas that awful boss I had for 8 months back in 2014, that was just so heavy. And I learned a whole load of things about having to stand up for myself and not agreeing with things that I felt were unethical and so on and so on. And you don't realize those are going to come up until you actually start writing that stuff out. You think as a magician, I need to learn magic, I need to learn breath control for meditation, and later on there is some devotional work and stuff like that, as well as, again, in most of the mystery schools, some kind of technical papers that you'll be asked to write out. You know, something about maybe or your horoscope, or, you know, describe some of the rituals you went through in this grade and, you know, say what you made out of all of that. Just explaining yourself to yourself and what is important to you, which of course will again bring up this thing of the areas where you're scared or embarrassed or ashamed and need to look at what that's about. And this is a key tool that shouldn't be overlooked. Even if you're a freelancer just doing this on your own without being in the school, sit down and say, I'm going to write 10,000 words, you know, 25 pages or something, on what my life has been about. The friendship I had in grade school or high school, the enemies I had in high school, the difficult relationship with a relative and, you know, first job and how I messed it up, all of that stuff is showing you ways in which you have steered yourself through certain experiences. These are all indications and of what you really are, the actual center there that is trying to gain traction with its ultimate source. You also, from the autobiography, will learn patterns. This is very much the Yesod work. The moon is cyclical. The moon is the planet of the sphere of Yesod, the foundation. And that's where patterns and repetitive behavior come out. I even found at one point thinking, well, I did all that Yesod stuff years ago, and realized I was talking about the same few topics every single talk, whatever my nominal subject was. I was just going on and on about the same stuff. Partly that's because that's what I have learned and that's what I can teach. But also I needed to look at it and say, what else could I do to step out of that safe zone of the known and go into the unknown? Because every one of us has some form of, you know, the psycho jargon's taken over too much these days. We're talking about addiction and trauma and words like that too much. And there's a pushback, which I think is healthy. But we're all addicted to some things. We're all habituated to certain things, to use an older word. And looking at what that's about, and is it a substitute for something? I mean, a quick example from my own life was after I made a start in my life looking at esoteric matters in my 20s, I ended up marrying, having kids, doing the middle-class thing in the suburbs. I cut myself off by conscious choice, feeling this was for the best, ha ha, and ended up getting interested in wine. And I did a lot of writing about winemaking and wine appreciation. for various publications in the Toronto area that are no longer in existence, simply because there's a mystique and a mystery around wine. You know, I mean, why is it that this vineyard produces something that's fine with the pizza, no problem, and this one produces something that costs seven times as much and is really quite remarkable? It's just something in the soil and how that particular type of grape reacts to it. Also, you might have a winemaker who just knows a couple of tricks that he's not going to tell anyone. And that produces something quite extraordinary. The whole mystique and mystery thing around wine became a kind of gnosis for me. It's not that I've lost interest in wine. I still love the stuff. But that was a pattern that I had to follow. I had to have something there that was a special knowledge. I couldn't live without that. I didn't feel life was meaningful without something special. And I think, again, you know, so much spiritual doctrine, teaching, practices, oh, you must be humble, you must not stand out. Thelema says this is utter nonsense. Of course you must, because you cannot establish the link with the HGA until you've actually identified what you are, yes, what your limitations and problems and anxieties are, but also your strengths and your powers. You're going to need quite a lot of power to get yourself up to the point where your energy allows you to communicate with the HGA and to receive those things I was talking about before, whether it's smelling the roses or hearing the roses, if that's what you want to do, or getting the pricklings on the scalp or the silences, whatever. But that's all important stuff to work on. So on the one hand, you mustn't get too paranoid here, you know, attributing ever minor coincidence to profound guidance coming through from on high. I mean, the usual mark of the beast is like an X within a circle. There is that symbol that we have in the Temple of the Silver Star, and other Thelemic schools use it. Periodically, somebody comes on a Thelemic discussion group and says, this is the same as the ancient Egyptian hieroglyph for a town. Yes, that's absolutely true. And the point here is, and then they go, well, they're the same, so they must have some significant connection. I suppose you could create one. And if you're sufficiently inventive as a Kabbalist, you could probably, you know, spend a whole evening talking about the similarity of the mark of the beast with an X in the middle of a circle that the Egyptians used, but I don't see anything there at all. So we need to be open to receiving stuff, but we also need to be open to not getting caught up in things. Important points as we make the journey here.
And I guess it's also something to be said for the success is your proof. Is there something value in your discoveries? You know, if it's just leading you down a rabbit hole that is an unending rabbit hole that doesn't really lead anywhere, then that might not be doing you any good. It might just be feeding kind of the madness and having you lose track. I'm yet again reading about, I'm reading Crowley's letters between him and Ahad, Frater Ahad, yet again from another perspective, but been following, speaking of rabbit holes. Yeah, so I've been reading that ever since Michael and I had been doing episodes on some of Frater Ahad's works. And so it's really interesting to follow up on getting a clear idea of Charles Stanfield Jones and his relationship with Crowley and their interactions and that sort of thing. I think that he's a good kind of guidepost and warning for a lot of that type of thing, where it's like, some of the stuff he came up with was really worth, like, it did have some kind of worth to it, and there was something there. But he had a nasty habit of just going off on these tangents that were like Kabbalist, reading into the newspapers, every little detail meant something, and taking that Master of the Temple oath of seeing everything in your environment as a direct message from God to yourself. And that just, he went kind of off the deep end with that, it seemed like.
Well, there's messages and messages. I mean, in my email every morning, there's, you know, there's an interesting post by somebody on Facebook. So, of course, I immediately delete it. And then there might be a link to a newsletter or a commentary site or a podcast that I am interested in. You've got to prioritize stuff. One thing I have, I think, determined to my own satisfaction is, A, I'm an incredibly stubborn person. And my HGA is quite willing to play that game with me and keep on knocking me on the back of the head until finally I say, okay, what is this? But asking what is this might be one of the hardest occult skills to master. You have to be able to say, I'm really open to receive information right now. There has to be a wanting there, a real desire. There has to be some actual will, but it can't be too frenzied, too emotionally needy. Oh God, I need to know right now exactly what's going on. Do I? I mean, there's a whole life here that is tied in with this true will stuff. It's not a separate thing that you get sorted out and then you get your KNC and then, you know, life just, you know, you sail through life on the bark of Ra and go around the earth every day and night and see yourself as absolutely wonderful. It does, the HGA does come back. It does communicate and it does persist until finally we begin to see what it is that's coming to us. Couple of other points I'd like to make generally about KNC. First of all, Crowley always said, anything that isn't in some way aimed at KNC is essentially black magic. You just, by which he meant, you know, you're feeding the separate self. In the end road, the end of the road for you is the black brother, the person who will not give up that power and authority and self-regard that is the vice side of Chesed. He's not willing to go over the abyss. Not that I'm suggesting everyone should go over the abyss. You mentioned Frater Achad, and I think he's a classic case of somebody who went too far, too fast, and never quite really recovered his equilibrium. He was always trying to work too many extremes together into one middle point. But probably we all have a bit of that ambition because will tends to show up as ambition a lot of the time. And on its own, it's not a bad thing, provided it's in harmony with the general aim of our life. You know, we are providing more material means for ourselves, more income by a certain type of work. It may not be ideal, but it means we can travel to meet other Thelemites, go and see places around the world and broaden our consciousness that way, go and buy more books about Crowley and so on and so on. So that's, you know, an important thing to do, the ambition side. There's a kind of a dark mirror image of that, which I think is a kind of, what are we going to call this? Spiritual paranoia, deistic anxiety. Christianity is very much about fear of God. Fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. I forget where that quote comes from, but it shows up in the Christian churches from time to time. And there are times when we can lose our own strength of direction, our own stamina on our own path. And therefore, you've got this awareness of something that is a far greater context of consciousness than we have normally. But when you're doing magic, when you're working thelemically, you are aiming to meet it at a certain elevated level, whereas the whole thing of the old aeon is negating yourself, and the HGA has too much power. Therefore, what comes through is very gevuric, and it is very much something because it's an unstable idea, it's too much over to one side of the tree, it tends to get projected onto other people. And you find that the haunted person with this kind of idea tends to try and impose a lot on other people. Whereas the self-confident person can say, well, okay, if that's what you want to do with your spiritual explorations, let me know what you get. Show me, you know, what results you have. I'll be interested to find out. There is therefore going to be a certain amount of this cosmic paranoia that comes in at certain times when you're working through the tree of life in order to attain to knowledge and conversation. I don't think you have to be haunted all the time, but I've occasionally found if I've lost my own balance, if I've lost my own focus, you know, for 2 or 3 days, it might happen. Suddenly I fear that there's a force there that's going to break or crush me. And it takes a bit of effort, quite a bit of banishing and remembering that magic stuff I learned in the temples and mystery schools. You know, do that stuff to bring yourself back into correct relationship. You're no use to the angel if you are somebody who just denies what they are at their center. You need to be that which you are and not something that is enslaving itself. People go on about Christianity enslaving us. That the fact is, at the end of the day, we have enslaved ourselves. Mm-hmm. The soul shall serve, says the book of the law, because that's all you can do if you allow yourself to be enslaved. If you are willing to try to get the greater self-knowledge, the greater awareness of compulsive patterns, and you're willing to keep pushing on beyond where you've gotten to at the present time, then you are going to be able to embrace a much grander concept of what the HGEA is all about. One slightly related topic, but it's a little bit of a segue, but I was looking at that list I gave earlier about the different things people received in the way of hints that they were kind of in the zone of the angel. And this whole talk is not about this is how you get to the knowledge and conversation, but rather beginning to recognize that you're on the track towards that. If you look at the cards at the top of the tree, you find that, well, Zayin, the sword, the lovers, to that is attributed smell. So that my friend who felt that her HGA was present or interacting when she had that smell was guided in a lot of ways by what's in that card, the whole mystery that is of the chemical marriage that is celebrated there. There was a whole lot of content for her in that. The Magus Beth, right up at the top of the tree, is concentration. So people who are really adept at meditation and dhyanic focusing are probably getting their, how are we going to say this without getting too biased in the comment, getting a lot of their inspiration of how to find the HGA through that particular path. It's coming down at some point from that. That's Mercury, the Magus. Some people find, I was talking earlier about autobiographies, that going over the past and bringing up memory, which is also attributed to Hesed, but I'm just looking at the paths that are related to the tarot right now, the connecting paths on the tree. Memory is Gimel, the priestess. Everything deep in memory is found on that path or reactivated, because critical memories are things that the HGA, working from Ketha, it works from all over the place, but specifically from Ketha, it's going to send memory to us through that path of Gimel, coming all the way down to the center of things in Tifereth. Daleth, the Empress, that is creative imagination. Daleth means a door. So there's a good metaphor there for creative imagination. Then you've got Cheth, the chariot. Cheth is an enclosure. It means an enclosure. The chariot is speech. The enclosure perhaps there might be the mouth, the voice box, parts of the body that produce speech. And of course, there's an analogous thing on a non-physical level. Teth, lust, Leo, that is taste, which taste is quite evocative, but I'm thinking again of what I was saying earlier about having an affinity for wine and how wine is made, because it conveys through taste some extraordinary perceptions that just don't happen with regular food. It's something on another level. Not everyone gets it. Some people have no idea what you're talking about. That's fine. And the same as it's fine that other people don't understand anything about astrology or visualization or voices in our heads. It's just a particularly personal thing. But you may find that taste as a sensory impression, or something just, you know, in the mouth that prods you to see things or experience things in a particular way, is tied to the fact that you're being communicated with via that path. Yod, the hermit, Virgo, that's touch, because it's about sexual union. That is the significance of that path. But all kinds of tactile aspects of the world, including, I think, sometimes you can look at a bunch of trees or plants or an animal and almost know what it would feel like to touch that. I look at my dogs here, and sometimes it's almost like I am touching them, because they are being playful and they want attention and they like being touched. There's a tactile relationship there, even if I'm not actually touching them at that moment. My point about this is one other thing, actually two other things. The path of Vav, the Hierophant, is attributed to hearing. So if you are the sort of person who gets sound vibrations or words, then you're getting information from the HGA via that particular path. That's Taurus. That's one of the critical magical arts in classical magic. Creative imagination from the Daleth, the Empress, is very much visual stuff. The Hierophant produces the oral stuff, the stuff that is heard, the words, the sounds, maybe just a vibration or a mantra that we can hear in the distance. One time I was in a group ritual where we all insisted we had heard of Pan's flute playing in the background, even though nobody had a musical instrument in the room. And lastly, I would add Hay, the star, Aquarius, which is related to sight. Hay, of course, is a window. So that's also related to visualizing stuff. I just mentioned that laundry list. They're found in all kinds of books, like Robert Wang's Kabbalistic Tarot, because it tells you something about how the HGA is attempting to reach through to you. At this point in your life, this is something that you can recognize, so I will speak to you, I being the angel, not me, and we'll see if we can establish a more solid relationship on that basis. It's just worth looking at those cards and allowing free association to take you through some very subjective logic to get you to understand what that type of communication is all about. Anyway, that's, you know, a bunch of ideas that I felt I could throw out just as hints to people. When you're working through, when odd stuff happens, or you find, especially I find in the preparatory stages of a ritual, there's some information coming through, some sound, some image, some idea, take a look at what is that relates to Kabbalistically on the Tree of Life and think, okay, there might be something that I need to look at there. Maybe it's related to my astrological chart. Maybe it's related to some other characteristic of my nature, but it's telling me something about how to get further information. It's going to be a very strange process. Whatever you do, you cannot make it sound sensible to anybody else. It's deeply intimate and deeply subjective. But learning to note the clues that come through without, as we noticed before, getting too paranoid about every slight coincidence. Oh, look, there's a car number plate with a 93 on it. Well, you know, lovely, okay, but does it actually relate to anything in your life today or not? It's just simply the universe waving at you, saying, hi. There's nothing particularly significant to that. But when something comes through repeatedly, then look to see what the associations are according to Sefiroth or any other list of correspondences you have. And let whatever that symbol was, the sound, the smell, the sight, the word, the idea, talk to you. It may be something minor that you've just not paid much attention to. It may be a temporary thing. I've often got into something very intensely for a year or two, and then, well, okay, that work is done. There's a particular form of communication possible now, but let's go on to a more difficult thing where there's no established communication and see what we can do there. Anyway, those are some ideas I wanted to toss out in this podcast, just for people trying to make some sense out of KNC. And to that man that I was futilely arguing with on Facebook, I doubt that he'll listen to this, but he might want to consider that, you know, this is not something that nobody can understand. It's something where we do have information and hints that we know how to start. And once you've started, you've begun. And once you've begun, you can continue.
You are on the way.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for reminding yourself that it's okay to not know, you know?
Yes. Absolutely, yes. Don't try. If you can't figure it out, don't figure it out. But leave it open. You know, further information is required. And maybe on a nice, quiet Thursday evening, you can sit down in your temple space and something will just pop into your head. That is, I think, perhaps one of the most common markers on the road to knowledge and conversation, or to use a phrase I've used many times before, rumors and murmurs, like the preceding stages of an awareness of what this thing might be, the scope of the HGA, the significance of it, the totality of the thing that's there. Let it drop a hint in and see what that hint opens for you.
Yeah, I was thinking of that. I feel like this is probably the ideal place to close off, but I can't help mentioning. There's, you mentioned Heth as the path that it refers to an enclosure. I usually think of it like, I think it's often listed as a fence, meaning a fence, but parsing it as an enclosure is a really interesting alternative to that particular wording and offers a little bit more insight into it. And the idea of it being related to speech brings to my mind the idea that by putting something into words, you're creating an enclosure. You're taking something that's unlimited and you're making it limited. You're giving it a specificity that it didn't necessarily have up until that moment, which it makes sense that that would be the path of Keth, would be proceeding down below the abyss where things are now taking a more concrete form. And it's kind of like, well, that's relates a little bit to what we were talking about with the whole idea of this gentleman making a bold statement about how things are, which any one of us can do at any given moment. But it's nice to remember that that's, you know, that's a limiting factor that's not necessarily true in all cases at all times.
I do remember a quote, and I can't, it might be Magic Without Tears, but where Crowley mentioned that the commentaries he put out on the Book of the Law was something that he would not have dared to do the older he got. He felt that he had to step back much more and allow people to form their own relationship to the book, form their own understanding, And there was a bit of danger of him imposing his own ideas too strongly in a way that makes people block their own the communications from their own HGA.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might have happened to me at certain phases in my own career. I thought, oh, well, I was told this, so I'll dismiss that funny idea that occurred to me when I was doing a, you know, an earth pentagram the other night, because no, that I must be wrong. Hmm. No, that just happens to be my relationship here, my dealings with the angel. And the best teachers out there leave a lot of things open and say, well, you know, learn the basic tricks, learn the basic techniques, learn as much as you can about the classic magical methods. But then you're going to have to walk the road all on your own. Mm-hmm. But at least at that point, you have the methods you're going to need for when you screw up, getting back again into the center, which I think is a very important part of spiritual progress in Kabbalistically. Screwing up is part of the learning process, because you have to go outside of the bounds you set yourself to understand just what the real boundaries are. So making a mistake and learning to observe it, this is one of those times when the magical diary comes in very critically. You know, keep a record of the error that you made and don't say, well, it's kind of embarrassing, I won't put that down. No. The ways you messed up are extremely vital to you in future. Don't forget them. And the angel is still there in the mess up. Hmm. It's just a different way of relating to the angel through a messed up situation, where you have to untangle things and recenter, as opposed to when you're flying high and everything's clear and your last invocation were just fabulous and you think, okay, I've really got it now. I know what I'm doing here, and I'm good.
Hmm.
So it's a funny, funny, funny path, and it goes all over the place. But learning to listen and notice and heed respectfully, but without surrendering critical faculties, is absolutely essential to keeping your feet on the ground and your head above the heavens.
Well, thanks very much. I think this will be some great food for thought, food for hearing, maybe. I don't know. Let's mix our metaphors a little bit.
Or spelling. Take time to hear the roses.
Exactly. Take the time to stop and hear the roses.
Okay.
You can't smell them anymore, so. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again and helping me to kick off yet another season of Darkly Splendid Abodes. Season 4. Listen for it. Thanks again, Edward. 93. Thanks for listening. Look for Toronto Thelema on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Watch for events in the city. And join us again in the Darkly Splendid Abodes.